Chapter 5. In reality, Varvara Ardalionovna had in her conversation with her brother somewhat exaggerated the certainty of her news concerning Mushkin's engagement to Aglaya Epanchin. Perhaps, like a sharp-sighted woman, she divined what was bound to come to pass in the immediate future. Perhaps, disappointed at her dream, in which, however, she had never really believed, passing off in smoke, she was too human to be able to deny herself the gratification of instilling added bitterness into her brother's heart by exaggerating the calamity, even though she loved him sincerely and felt sorry for him. In any case, she could not have received such exact information from her friends the Epanchins. There were only hints, half-uttered words, meaningful silences and surmises. Though perhaps Aglaya's sisters gossiped a little with design, so that they might themselves find out something from Varvara Ardalionovna. It may have been that they, too, could not forego the feminine pleasure of teasing a friend a little, though they had known her from childhood. They could not in so long a time have failed to get at least a glimpse of what she was aiming at. On the other hand, Mushkin, too, though he was perfectly right in assuring Lebediev that he had nothing to tell him, and that nothing special had happened to him, may have been mistaken. Something very strange certainly was happening to all of them. Nothing had happened, and yet at the same time, a great deal had happened. Varvara Ardalionovna, with her unfailing feminine instinct, had guessed this last fact. It is very difficult, however, to explain in proper orderly fashion how it came to pass that everyone in the Epanchin's house was struck at once by the same idea, that something vital had happened to Aglaya, and that her fate was being decided. But as soon as this idea had flashed upon all of them, at once all insisted that they had felt misgivings about it, and foreseen it long ago, that it had been clear since the episode of the poor knight, and even before, only, at that time, they were unwilling to believe in anything so absurd. So the sisters declared. Lizaveta Prokofievna, of course, had foreseen and known everything long before anyone, and her heart had ached about it long ago. But whether she had known it long ago or not, the thought of the prince suddenly became very distasteful to her, because it threw her so completely out of her reckoning. Here was a question which required an immediate answer. But not only was it impossible to answer it, but poor Lizaveta Prokofievna, however much she struggled, could not even see the question quite clearly. It was a difficult matter. Was the prince a good match or not? Was it all a good thing or not? If it were not a good thing, and undoubtedly it was not, in what way was it not good? And if perhaps it were good, and that was also possible, in what way was it good again? The head of the family himself, Ivan Fyodorovitch, was of course first of all surprised, but immediately afterwards made the confession that, by Jove, he'd had an inkling of it all this time. Now and again, he seemed to fancy something of the sort. He relapsed into silence at the threatening glance of his wife. He was silent in the morning, but in the evening, alone with his wife and compelled to speak, suddenly, and as it were with unwonted boldness, he gave vent to some unexpected opinions. I say, after all, what did it amount to? Silence. All this was very strange, of course, if it were true, and he didn't dispute it, but... Silence again. And, on the other hand, if one looked at the thing without prejudice, the prince was a most charming fellow, upon my word, and, well, the name, our family name, all that would have the air, so to say, of keeping up the family name, which had fallen low in the eyes of the world. That was looking at it from that point of view. Because they knew what the world was. The world was the world. But still the prince was not without fortune, if it was only a middling one. He had... Prolonged silence, and a complete collapse. When Lizaveta Prokofievna heard her husband's words, her anger was beyond all bounds. In her opinion, all that had happened was unpardonable and criminal folly, a sort of fantastic vision, stupid and absurd. In the first place, this little prince was a sickly idiot, and in the second place, a fool. He knew nothing of the world and had no place in it. To whom could one present him? Where was one to put him? He was an impossible sort of democrat. He hadn't even got a post, and... And what would Princess Bielokonski say? And was this the sort of husband they'd imagined and planned for Aglaé? The last argument, of course, was the chief one. At this reflection, the mother's heart shuddered, bleeding and weeping, though, at the same time, something quivered within it, whispering to her, "In what way is the prince not what is wanted?" And that protest of her own heart was what gave Lizaveta Prokofievna more trouble than anything. Aglaé's sisters were for some reason pleased at the thought of Mushkin. It didn't even strike them as very strange. In short, they might at any moment have gone over to his side completely, but they both made up their minds to keep quiet. It had been noticed, as an invariable rule in the family, that the more obstinate and emphatic Lizaveta Prokofievna's opposition and objection were on any matter of dispute, the surer sign it was for all of them that she was already almost on the point of agreeing about it. But Alexandra did not find it possible to be perfectly silent. Her mother, who had chosen her long ago as her adviser, was calling for her every minute now, and asking for her opinions, and still more for her recollections. That is, how it had all come to pass. How was it nobody saw it? Why did no one say anything? What was the meaning of that horrid poor night? Why she was alone, Lizaveta Prokofievna, doomed to worry about everything, to notice and foresee everything, while the others did nothing but count the crows, and so on and so on. Alexandra was on her guard at first, and confined herself to remarking that she thought her father's idea rather true, that in the eyes of the world, the choice of Prince Mushkin as the husband of one of the Epanchins might seem very satisfactory. Gradually getting warmer, she even added that the prince was by no means a fool, and never had been, and as for his consequence, there was no knowing what a decent man's consequence would depend upon in a few years' time among us in Russia, whether on the successes in the service that were once essential, or on something else. To all this, her mamma promptly retorted that Alexandra was a nihilist, and this was all their hateful woman question. Half an hour later, she set off for town, and from there to Kameny Island to find Princess Bielokonski, who happened, fortunately, to be in Petersburg at the time, though she was soon going away. Princess Bielokonski was Aglaé's godmother. The old princess listened to Lizaveta Prokofievna's feverish and desperate outpourings, and was not in the least moved by the tears of the harassed mother. She even looked at her sarcastically. The old lady was a terrible despot. She would not allow even her oldest friends to be on an equal footing with her, and she looked on Lizaveta Prokofievna simply as her protégé, as she had been 35 years before, and she never could reconcile herself to the abruptness and independence of her character. She observed, among other things, that they were, as usual, in much too great a hurry, and were making a mountain out of a molehill, that so far as she had heard, she was not convinced that anything serious had really happened, and wouldn't it be better to wait until there was something to go upon? That the prince, in her opinion, was a nice young man, though sickly, eccentric, and of little consequence. The worst point about him was that he was openly keeping a mistress. Madame Epanchin was well aware that the princess was rather cross at the failure of Yevgeny Pavlovich, whom she had introduced to them. She went home to Pavlovsk in a state of greater irritation than when she had set out, and she fell foul of everyone at once, chiefly on the ground that they'd all gone crazy, and that things were not done like that by anyone whatever except by them. "Why were they in such a hurry? What has happened? So far as I can judge, I cannot see that anything has happened. Wait till there's something to go upon. Ivan Fyodorovich is always fancying things and making mountains out of molehills." The upshot of it was that they must keep calm, wait and look on coolly. But alas, the calm did not last 10 minutes. The first blow to her composure was the news of what had happened during her absence at Kameny Island. Madame Epanchin's visit had taken place on the day after Mushkin had paid a visit after midnight, instead of at 9 o'clock. In reply to their mother's impatient questions, the sisters answered in detail, to begin with, that nothing special had happened during her absence, that the prince had come, that for a long time, quite half an hour, Aglaé had not come down to see him, that afterwards she came down and at once asked Mushkin to play chess, that the prince did not know how to play, and Aglaé had beaten him at once, that she was very lively and had scolded the prince, who was horribly ashamed of his ignorance. She had laughed at him dreadfully, so that they were sorry to look at him. Then she suggested a game of cards, fools, but that had turned out quite the other way. The prince played fools in masterly fashion, like a professor. Aglaé had even cheated and changed cards, and had stolen tricks from under his very nose, and yet he had made a fool of her 5 times running. Aglaé got fearfully angry, quite forgot herself, in fact. She said such biting and horrid things to the prince that at last he left off laughing and turned quite pale when she told him at last that she wouldn't set foot in the room as long as he were there, and that it was positively disgraceful of him to come to them, especially at night, past 12 o'clock, after all that had happened. Then she slammed the door and went out. The prince walked out as though from a funeral, in spite of all their efforts to console him. All of a sudden, a quarter of an hour after the prince had gone, Aglaé had run downstairs to the veranda in such haste that she had not dried her eyes, and they were still wet with tears. She ran down because Kolya had come bringing a hedgehog. They'd all begun looking at the hedgehog. Kolya explained that the hedgehog was not his, that he was out for a walk with a schoolfellow, Kostya Lebedev, who had stayed in the street and was too shy to come in, because he was carrying a hatchet, that they had just bought the hedgehog and the hatchet from a peasant they had met. The peasant had sold them the hedgehog for 50 kopecks, and they had persuaded him to sell the hatchet too, because he might just as well, and it was a very good hatchet. All of a sudden, Aglaé had begun worrying Kolya to sell her the hedgehog. She got very excited about it, and even called Kolya darling. For a long time Kolya would not consent, but at last he gave way and summoned Kostya Lebedev, who did in fact come in carrying a hatchet, and very much abashed. But then it had suddenly appeared that the hedgehog was not theirs at all, but belonged to another, a third boy, called Petrov, who had given the two of them money to buy Schlosser's History for him from a fourth boy, which the latter, being in want of money, was selling cheap. That they had been going to buy Schlosser's History, but they hadn't been able to resist buying the hedgehog, so that it followed that the hedgehog and the hatchet belonged to the third boy, to whom they were carrying them, instead of Schlosser's History. But Aglaé had so insisted that at last they made up their minds and sold her the hedgehog. As soon as Aglaé had bought the hedgehog, she had, with Kolya's help, placed it in a wicker basket and covered it with a table napkin. Then she began asking Kolya to take it straight to the prince from her, begging him to accept it as a sign of her profound respect. Kolya agreed, delighted, and promised to do it without fail, but began immediately pestering her to know what was meant by the hedgehog and by making him such a present. Aglaé had answered that it was not his business. He answered that he was convinced there was some allegory in it. Aglaé had been angry and flew out at him, saying that he was nothing but a silly boy. Kolya at once retorted that if it were not that he respected her sex, and what was more, his own convictions, he would have shown her on the spot that he knew how to answer such insults. It had ended, however, in Kolya's carrying off the hedgehog in delight, and Kostya Lebedev had run after him. Aglaé, seeing that Kolya was swinging the basket too much, could not resist calling to him from the veranda, "Please don't drop it, Kolya darling," as though she had not been quarrelling with him just before. Kolya had stopped, and he too, as though he had not been quarrelling, had shouted with the utmost readiness, "I won't drop him, Aglaé Ivanovna. Don't you be uneasy," and had run on again at full speed. After that, Aglaé had laughed tremendously, and had gone up to her own room exceedingly pleased, and had been in high spirits the rest of the day. Lizaveta Prokofievna was completely confounded by this account. One might ask why, but she was evidently in a morbid state of mind. Her apprehension was aroused to an extreme point, above all, by the hedgehog. What did the hedgehog mean? What compact underlay it? What was understood by it? What did it stand for? What was its cryptic message? Moreover, the luckless Ivan Fyodorovitch, who happened to be present during the Inquisition, spoilt the whole business by his reply. In his opinion, there was no cryptic message in it, and the hedgehog was simply a hedgehog and nothing more. At most, it meant a friendly desire to forget the past and make it up. In a word, it was all mischief, but harmless and excusable. We may note in parenthesis that he had guessed right. Mushkin returned home, after being dismissed and ridiculed by Aglaia, and sat for half an hour in the blackest despair, when Kolya suddenly appeared with the hedgehog. The sky cleared at once. Mushkin seemed to rise again from the dead. He questioned Kolya, hung on every word he said, repeated his questions 10 times over, laughed like a child, and continually shook hands with the 2 laughing boys who gazed at him so frankly. The upshot of it was that Aglaia forgave him, and that he could go and see her again that evening, and that was for him not only the chief thing, but everything.
"What children we still are, Kolya! And how nice it is that we are such children!"
he cried at last, joyfully.
"The simple fact is she's in love with you, Prince, and that's all about it," Kolya answered authoritatively and impressively.
Mushkin flushed, but this time he said nothing, and Kolya simply laughed and clapped his hands. A minute later Mushkin laughed too, and he was looking at his watch every 5 minutes to see how time was going and how long it was till evening. But Madame Epanchin's mood got the upper hand of her, and at last she could not help giving way to hysterical excitement. In spite of the protests of her husband and daughters, she immediately sent for Aglaia in order to put the fatal question to her, and to extort from her a perfectly clear and final answer.
"To make an end of it once for all, to be rid of it, and not to refer to it again. I can't exist till evening without knowing."
And only then they all realized to what an absurd pass they had brought things. They could get nothing out of Aglaia except feigned amazement, indignation, laughter, and jeers at the prince, and at all who questioned her. Lizaveta Prokofievna lay on her bed, and did not come down till evening tea, when Mushkin was expected. She awaited his coming with a tremor, and almost went into hysterics when he appeared. And Mushkin, for his part, came in timidly, as it were feeling his way, looking into everyone's eyes and seeming to question them all because Aglaia was not in the room again, which made him uneasy at once. There were no other guests present that evening. The family was alone. Prince S. was still in Petersburg, busy over the affairs of Yevgeny Pavlovich's uncle.
"If only he could have been here and said something anyway," said Lizaveta Prokofievna to herself, deploring his absence.
Ivan Fyodorovich sat with a very puzzled air. The sisters were serious, and as though intentionally, silent. Lizaveta Prokofievna did not know how to begin the conversation. At last she vigorously abused the railway, then looked with resolute challenge at Mushkin. Alas, Aglaia did not come down, and Mushkin was lost. Losing his head and hardly able to articulate, he began to express the opinion that to improve the line would be exceedingly useful, but Adelaida suddenly laughed, and he was crushed again. At that very instant Aglaia came in. Calmly and with dignity, she made Mushkin a ceremonious bow, and solemnly seated herself in the most conspicuous place at the round table. She looked inquiringly at Mushkin. Everyone realized that the moment had come when all doubts would be removed.
"Did you get my hedgehog?"
Aglaia asked firmly and almost angrily.
"I did," answered Mushkin with a sinking heart, and he flushed red. "Explain at once what you think about it. That's essential for the peace of mind of Mama and all the family."
"Come, come, Aglaia," began the General, suddenly uneasy.
"This is beyond everything," said Lizaveta Prokofievna, for some reason suddenly alarmed. "It's not beyond anything, Maman," her daughter answered sternly at once. "I sent the prince a hedgehog today, and I want to know his opinion." "Well, prince?"
"What sort of opinion, Aglaia Ivanovna?"
"Of the hedgehog."
"That is, I suppose, Aglaia Ivanovna, you want to know how I took the hedgehog? Or rather, how I regarded the sending of the hedgehog, that is? I imagine in such a case... that is, in fact..."
He gasped and was silent.
"Well, you've not said much," said Aglaia, after waiting 5 seconds. "Very well, I agree to drop the hedgehog. But I am very glad that I can put an end to all this accumulation of misunderstanding. Let me know from you personally. Are you making me an offer or not?"
"Good heavens!" broke from Lizaveta Prokofievna. Mushkin started and drew back. Ivan Fyodorovich was petrified. The sisters frowned.
"Don't lie, Prince, tell the truth. I am persecuted with strange questionings on your account. Is there any foundation for these questions?
Well, I have not made you an offer, Aglaya Ivanovna, said Mushkin, suddenly reviving. But you know how I love you and believe in you. Even now, what I am inquiring is, do you ask for my hand or not?
I do, Mushkin answered with a sinking heart. A general stir of agitation followed.
All this is not the thing, my dear fellow, said Ivan Fyodorovitch, violently agitated. This is almost impossible if it's like this. Aglaya, forgive it, Prince, forgive it, my dear fellow. Lizaveta Prokofievna, he turned to his wife for assistance. You must go into it.
I refuse, I refuse, cried Lizaveta Prokofievna, waving her hands.
Allow me to speak, maman. I count for something in this business. The extreme moment of my fate is being decided.
This was the expression Aglaya used.
And I want to find out for myself, and I'm glad, besides, that it's before everyone. Allow me to ask you, Prince, if you cherish such intentions, how do you propose to secure my happiness?
I really don't know, Aglaya Ivanovna, how to answer you in this question.
What is there to answer?
Besides,
is it necessary? You seem to be embarrassed and out of breath. Take a rest and pull yourself together. Drink a glass of water, though they'll soon give you some tea.
I love you, Aglaya Ivanovna. I love you very much. I love no one but you, and don't jest, I implore you. I love you very much.
This is an important matter. Though we are not children, we must look at it practically. Have the goodness now to explain what your fortune is.
Oh, come, come, Aglaya. What are you doing? This is not the thing. Not the thing,
Ivan Fyodorovitch muttered in dismay.
Disgraceful, said Lizaveta Prokofievna in a loud whisper.
She's out of her mind, Alexandra whispered us loudly.
My fortune? That is money, said Mushkin, surprised.
Just so. I have
now 135,000, Mushkin muttered, reddening.
Is that all?
Said Aglaya aloud in open wonder, without the faintest blush.
It doesn't matter, though, especially with economy. Do you intend to enter the service?
I was thinking of preparing for an examination to become a private tutor.
Very appropriate. No doubt that will increase our income. Are you proposing to be a Kammerjunker?
A Kammerjunker? Well, I never imagined such a thing, but... But at this point, the two sisters could not contain themselves and burst into laughter. Adelaida had long noticed in the twitching features of Aglaya's face symptoms of imminent and irrepressible laughter, which she was, for a time, controlling with all her might. Aglaya looked menacingly at her laughing sisters, but a second later she too broke down and went off into a frantic, almost hysterical fit of laughter. At last she leapt up and ran out of the room.
"I knew it was all a joke and nothing more," cried Adelaida. "From the very beginning! From the hedgehog!"
"No! This I will not allow! I will not!" cried Lizaveta Prokofievna, suddenly boiling over with anger, and she hastened out after Aglaya.
The sisters ran out immediately after her. Mushkin was left alone in the room with the head of the family.
"This is, could you have imagined anything like it, Lyov Nikolaevich?"
General Epanchin cried abruptly, hardly knowing what he wanted to say.
"Oh, yes, seriously, speak!"
"I see that Aglaya Ivanovna was laughing at me," said Mushkin sadly.
"Wait a bit, my boy. I'll go, and you wait a bit, because you at least, Lyov Nikolaevich, explain to me how all this happened, and what does it all mean, looked at as a whole, so to say. You must admit, my boy, I'm her father. Anyway, I'm her father, and so I don't understand anything about it. You at least let me know."
"I love Aglaya Ivanovna."
"She knows that, and I think she has known it a long time." The general shrugged his shoulders.
"Strange. Strange! And are you very fond of her?"
"Very."
"This all seems so strange to me. That is, such a surprise and blow that, you see, my dear boy, it's not the fortune, though I did expect you had rather more, but, my daughter's happiness... In fact, are you in a position to secure her happiness and And what does it mean? Is it a joke or real on her side? Not on your side, but on hers, I mean.
Alexandra's voice was heard at the door, calling her father.
Wait a bit, my boy, wait a bit. Wait a bit and think it over. I'll be back directly, he said hurriedly, and almost in alarm he rushed out in response to the call.
He found his wife and daughter in each other's arms, mingling their tears. They were tears of bliss, tenderness and reconciliation. Aglaia was kissing her mother's hands, cheeks and lips. They were hugging each other closely.
"Here, look at her, Ivan Fyodorovich. There you have the whole of her," said Lizaveta Prokofievna.
Aglaia lifted her happy, tear-stained little face from her mother's bosom and looked at her father. She laughed aloud, jumped up to him, embraced him warmly and kissed him several times. Then she flung herself on her mother again and hid her face completely in her bosom so that no one could see it, and began crying again at once. Lizaveta Prokofievna covered her with the end of her shawl.
"What are you doing with us, you cruel girl? That's what I want to know,"
she said, but joyfully, as though she could breathe more easily now.
"Cruel. Yes, cruel,"
Aglaia assented suddenly.
"Spoilt. Good for nothing. Tell Papa that. Oh, yes, he's here. Papa, you're here. Do you hear?"
She laughed through her tears.
"My dear, my idol."
The general kissed her hand, beaming all over with happiness. Aglaia did not take her hand away.
"So you love this young man, then?" "No, no, no, I can't bear your young man. I can't endure him," cried Aglaia,
boiling over suddenly and raising her head.
"And if you ever dare again—" "I mean it, Papa, I mean it. Do you hear? I mean it."
And she certainly did mean it. She flushed all over and her eyes gleamed. Her father was nonplussed and alarmed. But Lizaveta Prokofievna made a signal to him behind her daughter, and he took it to mean, "Don't ask questions."
"If it is so, my angel, it's as you like. It's for you to decide. He's waiting there alone. Shouldn't we give him a delicate hint to go away?"
Ivan Fyodorovich, in his turn, winked at his wife.
"No. No, that's not necessary. Especially a delicate one. You go to him yourself. I'll come in afterwards directly. I want to beg that young man's pardon, because I hurt his feelings."
Yes, you did dreadfully, Ivan Fyodorovich assented seriously.
"Well, then, you all had better stay here, and I'll go in first alone. You shall come directly after. Come the very second after. That's better."
She'd already reached the door, but suddenly turned back.
"I shall laugh. I shall die of laughing," she declared sorrowfully.
But at the same second she turned and ran in to Mushkin.
"Come, what's the meaning of it? What do you think?"
Ivan Fyodorovich began quickly.
"I'm afraid to say,"
Lizaveta Prokofievna answered as quickly.
"But to my mind it's clear."
"To mine, too. It's clear as day. She loves him."
"Not only loves, she's in love with him,"
put in Alexandra.
"But what a man, when you think of it." "God bless her, if such is her fate,"
said Lizaveta Prokofievna, crossing herself devoutly.
"It must be her fate," the general agreed. "Then there's no escaping fate."
And they all went into the dining room, where a surprise awaited them again. Aglaia, far from laughing as she had feared on going up to Mushkin, said to him almost shyly,
"Forgive a stupid, nasty, spoilt girl."
She took his hand.
"And believe me, we all respect you immensely. And if I dared to turn into ridicule your splendid, kind simplicity, forgive me, as you'd forgive a child for being naughty. Forgive me for persisting in an absurdity, which could not, of course, have the slightest consequence."
The last words Aglaia uttered with particular emphasis. The father, mother, and sisters were all in the drawing-room in time to see and hear all this, and all were struck by the words, "absurdity which cannot have the slightest consequence," and still more so by the earnestness with which Aglaia spoke of that absurdity. They all looked at one another questioningly, but Mushkin did not seem to understand those words, and was at the very summit of happiness.
"Why do you talk like that?" he muttered. "Why do you ask forgiveness?"
He would have said that he wasn't worthy of her asking his forgiveness. Who knows? Perhaps he did notice the meaning of the words, "absurdity which cannot have the slightest consequence." But being such a strange man, perhaps he was relieved at those words. There is no doubt that the mere fact that he could come and see Aglaia again without hindrance, That he was allowed to talk to her, sit with her, walk with her, was the utmost bliss to him. And who knows, perhaps he would have been satisfied with that for the rest of his life. It was just this contentment that Lizaveta Prokofievna secretly dreaded. She understood him. She dreaded many things in secret, which she could not have put into words herself. It's difficult to describe how completely Mushkin regained his spirits and courage that evening. He was so light-hearted that they grew light-hearted watching him, as Aglaya's sisters expressed it afterwards. He was talkative, and that had not happened to him again since the morning, 6 months ago, when he had first made the acquaintance of the Epanchins. On his return to Petersburg, he was noticeably and intentionally silent, and had quite lately said to Prince S., in the presence of all, that he must restrain himself and be silent, that he might not degrade an idea by his expressing it. He was almost the only one who talked that evening. He described many things. He answered questions clearly, minutely, and with pleasure. But there was not a glimpse of a word approaching love-making in his conversation. He expressed earnest, sometimes profound, ideas. Mushkin even expounded some of his own views, his own private observations, so that it would have been funny if it had not been so well expressed, as all who heard him that evening agreed later on. Though General Epanchin liked serious subjects of conversation, yet both he and Lizaveta Prokofievna secretly thought it was too intellectual, so that they felt actually sad at the end of the evening. But Mushkin went so far at last to tell some very amusing stories, which he was the first to laugh at, so that the others laughed more at his joyful laugh than at the story itself. As for Aglaya, she hardly spoke all the evening, but she listened all the while to Lyov Nikolaevich, and gazed at him even more than she listened. "She looks at him and can't take her eyes off him. She hangs on every word he utters. She catches everything," Lizaveta Prokofievna said afterwards to her husband. "But tell her that she loves him, and you'll have the walls about your ears." "Well, there's no help for it. It's fate," said the general, shrugging his shoulders. And long afterwards he kept repeating the phrase which pleased him. We will add that, as a businessman, he too disliked a great deal in the present position, above all its indefiniteness. But he too resolved for the time to keep quiet, and to take his cue from Lizaveta Prokofievna. The happy frame of mind of the family did not last long. Next day Aglaya quarrelled with Mushkin again, and things went on like that for several days. For hours together she would jeer at Mushkin, and make him almost a laughing-stock. It is true they would sometimes sit for an hour or two together in the arbour in the garden, but it was observed that at such times Mushkin almost always read aloud the newspaper or some book to Aglaya. "Do you know," Aglaya said one day, interrupting his reading of the newspaper, "I have noticed that you are dreadfully uneducated. You don't know anything thoroughly, if one asks you who someone is, or in what year anything happened, or the name of a treaty. You're much to be pitied."
"I told you that I have not much learning," answered Mushkin.
"What have you, if you haven't that? How can I respect you after that? Read on. Or rather don't. Leave off reading."
And again that evening there was something that mystified them all in her behaviour. Prince S. came back. Aglaya was very cordial to him. She made many inquiries about Yevgeny Pavlovich. Mushkin had not yet come in. Suddenly Prince S. permitted himself an allusion to another approaching event in the family, to a few words which had escaped Lizaveta Prokofievna, suggesting that they might have to put off Adelaida's wedding again in order that the two weddings might take place together. Aglaya flared up in a way no one could have expected at these stupid suppositions, and among other things the phrase broke from her that she had no intention at present of taking the place of anybody's mistress. These words struck everybody, and above all her parents. In a secret confabulation with her husband, Lizaveta Prokofievna insisted that he must go into the question of Nastasia Philipovna with Mushkin, once for all. Ivan Fyodorovitch swore that all this was only a whim, and put it down to Aglaya's delicacy, that if Prince S. had not referred to the marriage, there would not have been this outburst, because Aglaya knew herself, knew on good authority that it was all a slander of ill-natured people, and that Nastasia Philipovna was going to marry Rogozhin, that the prince had nothing to do with it, let alone a liaison with her, and never had had, if one's to speak the whole truth. Yet Mushkin went on being blissful and untroubled by anything, though of course he too noticed sometimes something gloomy and impatient in Aglaya's expression, but he had more faith in something different, and the gloom vanished of itself. Once having faith in anything, he could not waver afterwards. Perhaps he was too much at ease in his mind. So it seemed at least to Ippolit, who chanced to meet him in the park.
"Well, didn't I tell you at the time that you were in love?"
he began, going up to Mushkin and stopping him. Mushkin shook hands with him and congratulated him on his looking so much better. The invalid seemed hopeful himself, as consumptives are so apt to be. He had come up to Mushkin to say something sarcastic about his happy expression, but he soon drifted off the subject and began to talk about himself. He began complaining, and his complaints were many and long-winded, and rather incoherent.
"You wouldn't believe," he concluded, "how irritable they all are there, how petty, how egoistic, vain, and commonplace. Would you believe it, they only took me on condition of my dying as quickly as possible, and now they're all in a fury that I'm not dying. But on the contrary, better. It's a farce. I bet you don't believe me."
Mushkin had no inclination to reply.
"I sometimes think of moving back to you again,"
Ippolit added carelessly.
"So you don't think they're capable of taking a man in on condition of his dying as quickly as possible?"
"I thought they invited you with other views."
"You are by no means so simple as you are reputed to be. Now is not the time, or I tell you something about that wretched Ganya and his hopes. They're undermining your position, Prince. They're doing it mercilessly, and it's quite pitiful to see you so serene. But alas, you can't help it."
"That's a funny thing to pity me for," laughed Mushkin. "Do you think I should be happier if I were less serene?"
"Better be unhappy and know the truth than be happy and live like a fool. You don't seem to believe that you have a rival. And in that quarter?"
"What you say about a rival is rather cynical, Ippolit. I'm sorry I have not the right to answer you. As for Gavril Ardalionovitch, judge for yourself whether he can be happy in his mind after all he has lost. That is, if you know anything at all about his affairs. It seems to me better to look at it from that point of view. There's time for him to change. He has a life before him, and life is rich. Though Mushkin broke off uncertainly. "As for undermining, I don't know what you are talking about. Let's drop this conversation, Ippolit."
"We'll drop it for the time. Besides, you must always go in for being gentlemanly, of course." "Yes, Prince. You'd have to touch it with your finger in order to disbelieve it again." "And do you despise me very much now? What do you think?"
"What for? Because you have suffered and are still suffering more than we?"
"No, but because I am unworthy of my suffering."
"If anyone is able to suffer more, he must be more worthy of suffering. When Aglaya Ivanovna read your confession, she wanted to see you, but..."
"She's putting it off. She can't. I understand. I understand,"
Ippolit interrupted, as though anxious to break off the conversation as quickly as possible.
"By the way, they tell me that you read all that rigmarole aloud to her yourself. It was literally in delirium that I wrote it and did it. And I don't understand how anyone can be so... I won't say cruel, it would be humiliating for me, but so childishly vain and revengeful as to reproach me with that confession and to use it against me as a weapon. Don't be uneasy. I'm not talking about you."
"But I am sorry that you repudiate that manuscript, Ippolit. It is sincere, and you know that even the most absurd points in it, and there are many of them," Ippolit scowled, "are redeemed by suffering, because to confess them is suffering, and perhaps great manliness. The idea that animated you must have had a noble foundation, however it may seem. I see that more clearly as time goes on. I swear I do. I don't judge you. I speak to say what I think, and I'm sorry that I didn't speak at the time." Ippolit flushed hotly. The thought flashed through his mind that Mushkin was pretending and taking him in, but looking into his face, he could not help being convinced of his sincerity. His face brightened.
"Yet I must die all the same,"
he said, almost adding,
"a man like me. And only fancy how your Ganya plagues me. The objection he has trumped up is that three or four who heard my confession will very likely die before I do. What do you say to that? He supposes that's a comfort to me. In the first place, they haven't died yet, and even if these people did die, you'll admit that's no comfort to me. He judges by himself, but he goes further. He simply abuses me now. He says a decent man would die in silence, and that it's all egoism on my part. What do you say to that? Yes, what about egoism on his part? What refinement, and yet at the same time what ox-like coarseness of egoism, that they can't see it in themselves. Have you ever read Prince of the Death of Stepan Gliubov in the 18th century? I happened to read about it yesterday.
What Stepan Gliubov?
He was impaled in the time of Peter.
Oh dear, yes, I know. He was 15 hours on the stake in the frost, in a fur coat, and died with extraordinary grandeur. Yes, I read it. What of it?
God grant such deaths to men, but not to us. You think perhaps I'm not capable of dying like Gliubov?
Oh, not at all, Mushkin said, confused. I only meant to say that you... That is, not that you would not be like Gliubov, but that you... That you would be more likely then to be...
I guess like Osterman, and not Gliubov. That's what you meant to say.
What Osterman? Said Mushkin, surprised.
Osterman, the diplomat Osterman. Peter's Osterman,
muttered Ippolit, suddenly disconcerted. A certain perplexity followed.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to say that, Mushkin said emphatically, after a brief silence. You would never, I think, have been an Osterman.
Ippolit frowned. The reason I maintain that, though, Mushkin resumed suddenly, obviously anxious to set things right, is because the men of those days, I swear I've always been struck by it, were absolutely not the same people that we are now. It was not the same race as now, in our age, really. It seems we are a different species. In those days, they were men of one idea, but now we are more nervous, more developed, more sensitive. Men capable of two or three ideas at once. Modern men are broader-minded, and I swear that this prevents their being so all of a piece, as they were in those days. I simply said it with that idea, and not...
I understand. You're doing your level best to console me now for the simplicity with which you disagreed with me. You're a perfect child, Prince. I notice, though, that you all handle me like a china cup. I'm not angry. It's all right. Never mind. Anyway, we've had an awfully funny conversation. You're sometimes a perfect child, Prince. Let me tell you, though, that I should like perhaps to be something better than Osterman. It would not be worthwhile to rise from the dead for the sake of Osterman. I see I ought to die as soon as possible, though, or I myself shall... Leave me. Goodbye. Well, now, come. Tell me, what do you think would be the best way for me to die? To make a virtuous ending of it, as far as may be, that is. Come, tell me.
Pass by us, and forgive us our happiness, said Mushkin in a low voice.
Just as I thought. I knew it was sure to be something like that. There you are. You are. Well, you are eloquent people. Goodbye. Goodbye.